The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off with the Reader's Digest Leisure section. Here are tricks your favorite eateries use to separate you from your money. Secrets your menu won't tell you. Have you ever entered a restaurant craving a spinach salad only to end up ordering the pig roast special? Chances are the proprietors had a hand in that outcome. Be it a high-end eatery or a fast food joint, a restaurant's owners have clever ways to influence your choice. That soft background melody? A Scottish study found that diners spent 23% more when a slow tempo music was played. The red walls? That color stimulates appetite. And then there's the menu. With its mouth-watering prose and ample use of consumer psychology, of course you want to sample every dish. We've annotated a menu you might find at a typical medium-priced eatery. Which of these tricks have you fallen for? Appetizer. Crispified mozzarella sticks? The fine print. For some consumers, the dollar sign apparently screams, "Watch your wallet," because it says $12. A Cornell University study found that guests at one restaurant, given the numeral-only menu, spent significantly more than those who received a menu with prices showing a dollar sign. And then there's panko fried calamari at $9.95. That's interesting. I had calamari last night for dinner. The fine print prices ended with a 9, such as a $9.99, tend to signify value but not quality, said the New York Times. Most restaurants round up. If not, they go with 95. And then the arrow is pointing to the bourbon-braced short reed ribs at $10.95. The fine print. Names with lots of consonants that start with the lips and end with the throat, such as a B, tend to mimic the mouth movements of eating. These dishes were rated more flavorful than dishes with names featuring consonants that start from the back of the throat, i.e., the C in corn, says a study from the University of Cologne in Germany. Of course, I guess that's speaking German, too. And then the Aunt Louise's famous mac and cheese, $12. The fine print. A box around the name of a dish gives the impression that the item is special, says hospitality consultant Seg Frink. It works well for dishes that cost little to make and get marked up. And then there's the house salad with a leaf above it, $3.95. The fine print. When dining, healthy is a synonym for where is the flavor. So restaurants often don't reference health and indicate a dish is good for you by using a signpost, such as a leaf icon. Main courses. Arrow points to the title on this one. Tangy, plump, baby back spare ribs, $19. The fine print. People notice bold listings 42% more than plain type when they read, one study showed. As for the words tangy and plump, a different study authored by Cornell professor Brian Wozniak found that the artful use of adjectives increased sales by up to 27%. His study showed that those who ate foods with evocative descriptive menu names rated them as more appealing, tasty, and caloric than their regularly named counterparts. And then the arrow points to the next item, which is cheeseburgers and fries. A fine print italic typeface conveys a perception of quality, reports the BBC. A study conducted by Swiss and German researchers found that a wine labeled with a difficult-to-read script was liked more by drinkers than the same wine carrying a label using a simpler typeface. Isn't that interesting? And then there's another wrapped-around square thing with a little face like there's a chef in front of it. A meatloaf with summer whipped potatoes drenched in autumn root vegetables, winter squash, and who knows what else, because this point we're making things up to pad the dish's name so you'll notice it. The fine print, if boxes, huge fonts, italics don't catch your eye, how about a super long dish name? As the restaurant software company Toast points out on its blog, anything that is different will draw the eye. Golden twice-vide platter. And it has the arrow runs between a price of $45 and a price of $18 for the next item. The fine print. Most desired piece of real estate on the menu is at the top right, because that's the spot on the page where our eyes tend to be drawn first. So that's where restaurants' most profitable dish will likely be found. And below that is the tuna noodle casserole, the fine print. And when you place the most expensive dish at the top of the menu, says Willem Ponderstone, author of Priceless, The Myth of Fair Value, everything else near it looks like a relative bargain, even when it's not. Since when is a tuna casserole worth $18? Chef's recommendation, that's got an arrow, baked chicken. The fine print, faces like chef's recommendation are a way of telling you, order this. Restaurants use them to sell more their more profitable items and draw you away from your go-to dishes, which may not make them as much money. And then we get desserts. The arrow points to the sweet Georgia peach cobbler. The fine print. Restaurants use regional names to entice customers into ordering a particular dish, says Walsink. Want a good peach tart? Well, then, the peaches have to be from Georgia, of course. And the arrow pointing to Godiva Chocolate Brownie Sundae. The fine print. Brand names and menu items confer a trust, built-in trust and create a guarantee to diners that they will love the dish. Who knew? If some independence-minded citizens had gotten their way, we'd have a few more states on our flag. Eight almost states. Greetings from Absaruka is the big sign on the front of it. Rebels fighting for their freedom created our country, so it's not surprising that the spirit has bubbled over to decades on a smaller scale. From coast to coast in a worldwide variety of reasons, factions of citizens have proposed seceding from their parent states. Obviously, that's going on in California right now. Obviously, they didn't get their way, or the United States would include more than 50 members today. But some came close, drafting constitutions, electing governors, and dreaming up names. Although they've mostly been forgotten in history, these stories of these eight states that almost were are still fascinating. Absaroka, A-B-S-A-R-O-K-A. In 1939, the old boys of the Sheraton Rotary Club rallied around A.R. Strickland, a former professional baseball player, with a plan to stand up for the grassland ranches of northern Wyoming and western South Dakota by declaring for themselves a new state, to which southern Montana was later added. They called their proposed new home Absaroka, derived from the Crow word Aspaloke, which means children of the large-beaked bird. Already smarting from Dust Bowl devastation and perceived indifference from state legislature, the area was newly disaffected by its minuscule cut of the New Deal aid. With winking sincerity, Swickard proclaimed himself governor and oversaw a Miss Absaroka beauty contest. Novelty license plates were created, and after the King of Norway toured the area, dubious claims were made of official recognition. Today, the namesake Absaroka State Takeover, a rockabilly car show complete with pin-up girls and hot rods, occurs annually in Sheridan, Wyoming. Franklin even created its own currency based on not on bills and coins, but on animal skins. Deseret. In 1849, Mormon settlers tried to claim a massive region in the southwest near the Rocky Mountains and the Sierra Nevada, encompassing parts of what are now nine states of California, Oregon, Nevada, Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado. They set up their own government founded on Mormon principles, including polygamy, and elected church leader Brigham Young as their governor. Deseret, meaning honeybee in the Book of Mormon, could have been the largest state in the country. But many opposed the idea. In 1850, the federal government opted to give Young and his followers the much smaller Utah territory. Still, for years afterwards, a wishful-thinking group of Mormon elders met secretly after each legislative session and rewrote the day's new laws under the State of Deseret name. Franklin. After the Revolutionary War, some of North Carolina's frontier lands, now the northeastern portion of Tennessee, were settled initially by 5,000 or so pioneers who felt they were underrepresented by the faraway state capital. So they voted to secede, naming their new home Frankland and setting themselves up with a constitution, a governor, and a militia. They later changed the name to Franklin after Benjamin Franklin in hopes of gaining his support. They even created their own currency based on not on bills and coins, but on animal skins. The governor received a salary of 1,000 deer skins, while the secretary of state got 450 otter skins. After 4 years, the rebellion fizzled, and in 1789, Franklin's leaders decided to rejoin North Carolina. Its short-lived statehood prompted a clause in the U.S. Constitution prohibiting states from breaking up to form new states without the consent of the legislature. Jefferson. Locals in southern Oregon and northern California have tossed around ideas for the state of Jefferson since at least 1854. Nearly a century later, in 1941, the mayor of the small coastal town of Point Oxford, Oregon, along with a California judge and a state senator, pushed for self-determination after supportive ranchers and other locals took over a highway near the border between the states. With a provisional governor and hundreds of citizens marching in the streets of the proposed state capital, proclaiming about the state flower, anything but a pansy, Jefferson began to seem like a real possibility. But Pearl Harbor diverted the nation's attention and put on an end to the movement. Although some would say be Jeffersonians still hold onto hope. Over the years, two different factions, Texas and one in Kansas, have also proposed their own spinoff to be named Jefferson. Scott. Even geography buffs might be surprised to hear that the lost state of Scott technically existed as recently as 1986. During the Civil War, Scott County in rugged eastern Tennessee opted to break away from the rest of the state. Its citizens were hardy mountain people, not plantation owners or slaveholders. They distrusted the planter class and the cotton oligarchs and had an interest in joining them in the slavery-bound Confederacy. In fact, when the rest of the state voted to leave the Union, 95% of the area residents voted to stay, declaring themselves the free and independent state of Scott. The Tennessee state government largely ignored them, but the Confederacy dispatched troops to demand loyalty. The soldiers were quickly run out of the mountains, and legend says they took Scott's charter papers with them, destroying any real evidence of its existence. After the war, the tiny state of Scott was mostly forgotten until Tennessee's 125th anniversary, when it opted to join the celebrations by requesting readmittance. Sequoia. Seeking to claim a part of the United States as their own, Native Americans conceived the state of Sequoia in 1905. Named after the Cherokee leader who invented the tribe's written language, Sequoia was based on a tract of land in what was then called Indian Territory and what is now eastern Oklahoma, where Native Americans had been relocated by the U.S. government. Tribes had been granted sovereignty through a series of treaties, but the political climate was changing, and in 1898 Congress passed the Curtis Act, which would soon nullify their system of tribal government leaders of the five civilized tribes, the Cherokee, Choctaw, Creek, Chickasaw, and Seminoles. Petitioned for their own state of Sequoia, but Congress refused. Instead, President Theodore Roosevelt declared that the Indian Territory should be part of another new state, Oklahoma. Superior. Michigan's Upper Peninsula, or UP, contains about a third of the state's land and much of the lumber and mining resources, but only about 3% of the population lives there, leaving its residents feeling underrepresented in the state government. The Upers, as UP residents call themselves, that's Y-O-O-P-E-R-S, call themselves, have been known to refer to downstate residents, trolls, because they live below the suspension bridge that connects the two parts of the state across the four-mile-long Strait of Mackinac. The upstate-downstate rivalry has sporadically prompted talk of secession among the proud Upers for more than a century, so much so that the UP has gone through a few proposed names, including Superior, Sylvania, meaning Pleasant Woody area, and reported to have been Thomas Jefferson's ideal, and the Ontonagon, after a village and county in the region. The last time an independence measure came up for public vote in the 1980s, the secession effort fell short of the majority of state legislatures needed to present the plan to Congress. Westylvania. Before the Revolutionary War, a cluster of land speculators tried to form a colony called Vandalia, made up of modern West Virginia, western Pennsylvania, and eastern Kentucky. The war doomed their plan, and in 1776 they tried to reform their adopted home as the state of Westylvania. But that effort failed too, as Congress ignored their petition. Frustrated, residents threatened to form their own new state anyway. But Pennsylvania, which then owned most of the area, passed a law declaring that such agitation to be treasonous and punishable by execution, quickly squashing the uprising. Now, this next story is kind of timely because of the event in Thailand recently with caving. Drama in real life. Six caving buddies set off for a day of adventure. By nightfall, only four of them have emerged from the deep. No way out. And there's a picture of a man with a headlight and a flashlight named Jason Story peering through a tight passage in a cave called Cascade. The rain comes down steady and hard. Jason Story hears it, but is not worried as he prepares for a day of caving with five friends in a remote spot 80 miles northwest of his home in Duncan on Canada's Vancouver Island. He is dressed for the wet weather, and just for about any other predicament, a T-shirt, then two sweatshirts, a pair of overalls, neoprene socks, water-resistant jacket, and rubber boots. Under his arm, he proudly carries his new helmet and headlamp. "Sleep in," he whispers, bending down to kiss his wife, Caroline's Story. "B Be careful, she says. Always. It's 6 a.m. on December 5, 2015. A newcomer to the sport, Jason has gone caving only four times. This will be his toughest outing yet, a cave called Cascade. It's dangerous enough that the entry is blocked by a locked metal door to keep the casual spelunker out. The key can be attained only after everyone in the caving party signs a waiver. About a mile long and 338 feet deep, Cascade is full of turns and barely passable tight squeezes. A claustrophobe's nightmare. You wouldn't get me in there, that's for sure. Jason is the outlier among the group, with the least experience and at 43, older by a decade or more. A stocky father of two toddlers, he is a university drama graduate turned entrepreneur, the owner of a window washing company. It was his friend, Andrew Munoz, 33, who introduced him to the sport. Unlike Jason, Andrew is an expert caver, a former caver guide, actually, and a wiry paramedic who would know what to do if something were to go wrong. Jason, Andrew, and two more friends, Adam Shepard, also a paramedic, and Zach Zoriski, a chief and volunteer firefighter, drive through the heavy rain to the parking lot of a log cabin candy store in Port Alberni, where they get the key to that metal door. There they meet up with Matt Watson and Arthur Taylor, both computer programmers. The six men drive up an unmarked trail for half a mile before parking in a clearing to take inventory. Ropes, harnesses, and carabiners? Check. Two bags that contain a small gas-fueled jet boil stove, food, water, and first aid kit, and a Mylar space blanket that resembles aluminum foil. Check, check, and further check. They hike a bit before coming to the door, which sits in the ground. You'd miss it if you weren't looking for it. It's 10 a.m. They pull the door open and climb 30 feet down a rickety aluminum ladder into the black, each of them anchored with carabiners to a rope. The last one in locks the door behind him and ties the key to the bottom of the ladder. It is damp and chilly, about 41 degrees. With the way illuminated by headlamps, they walk down a narrow passage studded with jagged boulders. The silence is broken by a drip, drip, drip from above. Soon the drip turns into a light but steady flow, and they are wading in water up to their ankles, then at their shins. Everyone okay? Andrew, the de facto leader of the group, calls out. Yeah, come the replies. Yep, me too. And there's a picture of the two of them, Jason and Double Trouble, on a later expedition. Apparently he goes back. About 45 minutes in, Adam announces he can't go any farther. His back, injured a few weeks earlier, is twinging. The constant hunching over has taken its toll. Matt escorts him to the entrance to let him out. He closes and locks it again, then rejoins his four waiting friends. For the next 90 minutes, they are explorers, taking their time as they crawl, stride, and slide through the cave's two very different environments, either pipe-like passages, barely big enough to fit a grown man, or chambers that are like the nave of a church, big but not overwhelming. Wherever they go, they try to stay within 100 feet from the first person to the last, congregating in the chambers between the more challenging crawls and climbs. Jason is in awe of his surroundings. Andrew once told him, there are over 1,000 caves and tunnels on Vancouver Island, and it's never the same. Cascade is like nothing he's seen before. Soon they approach one of the features that make the cave unique, a narrow passage not big enough to stand up, and that leads to a short, tight downhill. This has a name, Bastard's Crawl. Four streams meet here, and indeed the water is flowing more quickly. Crab walk, Andrew calls. Once they emerge from Bastard's Crawl, they approach the top of a waterfall called Double Trouble, so named because of a jutting rock splits the stream in two. They set up their ropes and rappel 50 feet. Boots and glove hands claw for leverage on the slippery ledges. The water gushes on either side of the rock formation, landing at the bottom in a spray of bubbles. There's a reason this cave is called Cascade. As Jason descends, his heart is beating so hard it feels as if it will jump out of his chest. You want a harder challenge, he thinks? You got it. And there's a graphic of inside Cascade. With its narrow passages, flowing streams, and chambers studded with stalagmites and stalactites, Cascade is a caver's dream, but for the novice spelunker, can turn into a nightmare. And the first graphic shows a vertical drop, which is where the ladder is, from the entrance of 50 feet. Then there's a slope downward, looks like it's about 30 degrees slope downwards, to a flat area where you turn and go horizontally for a ways to a place called the theater room, which apparently is a fairly large thing. At that point, you're 100 feet deep. Then you go through another passage, a large opening, which have, with a lot of obstacles like rocks and things like that. And there's a thing called the tight squeeze, which is 20 feet long. And then, once again, it's a horizontal crawl for about an equal distance as the one above. Then there's a drop down, another 45 or so feet straight down. That's apparently where they had the ropes and stuff. And then it kind of flattens out again and goes horizontally. It looks like it's a fairly large area. Then there's the Bastard's Crawl. And that's a drop down about 20 feet, it looks like, and then kind of slopes down more of a horizontal crawl, but actually probably about a 20-degree average down to the end, where the Cascade, which is where the waterfall is that drops down. And the cave is actually longer than that, but that's as far as they got. Anyway, a few minutes beyond Double Trouble, they stop for a quick bite. It's just before 1 p.m., and they've been in a cave for 3 hours. Andrew fires up the jet boil to make beef and chicken stew with rice. After their 20-minute lunch, the five head out again, sliding and crawling their way down toward the cave's end, less than a quarter mile away. But they only get down 300 feet when Zach begins shivering violently. Although the temperature hasn't changed, the cold inside the cave can be hit unexpectedly. The five decide to turn back together. They start to retrace their route. First Matt goes, then Arthur, then Jason, Zach, and Andrew. The sound of rushing water grows louder. There is more mud than there was on the way down a few hours earlier, and it sticks heavily to their heels. Plus, they are now climbing up, so it's taking much longer to return than it did to come down. Careful, one of the cavers front yells to those behind. As it nears 2:15 p.m., the cavers approach Double Trouble. The sound of water has turned into a roar. What had been a gushing but manageable flow is now a churning, angry, right froth. How could this happen so quickly? Jason wonders. Is it runoff from the rain? It kind of sounds like the thing in Thailand. Matt hooks the rope to the left attached to the top of Double Trouble to his harness and starts hauling himself up. The journey is not long, maybe 50 feet, but it's tough, precise work, hoisting one leg to find a tiny wet shell in the walk wall, and then a gloved hand, then the other leg. Once he has climbed to the top, he throws the rope down and Arthur follows suit. Then Jason. At the top, Jason gets on his stomach to pull himself up the incline of Bastard's Creek. Crawl. The water, deeper than before, smashes into his face as he powers through it. God, it's cold. Finally emerging through the opening and into the next tight passage, he pauses puzzled, because it splits in two. He can't see the two cavers ahead of him and is nervous about waiting at the top because there is really only room in the spot for one person at a time. I'll just go back down and ask, he decides. He carefully crab walks about 15 feet when the streaming water suddenly sweeps him onto his back, submerging him. He feels the pressure of more water building up behind him. If he doesn't get out of the crawl fast, the merciless surge of water will pop him out like a champagne cork over Double Trouble and onto the rocks below. But he can't move. His boot is stuck between two rock shelves. Lying on his back with the water rushing over him, he tries to call for help, but instead he gasps frantically for air. It has been about 5 minutes. It feels like forever. Images of his family flash before him like a mental photo album. He tries to hold on to Caroline, who he's been married to for 16 years and who warned him to be careful that morning, Jack, 5, who loves airplanes, and 3-year-old Poppy, his princess. Zach, having followed Jason up, is now atop Double Trouble. He shouts down to Andrew, Jason's in trouble. Andrew clambers up behind Zach and goes to the bottom of the crawl. Head up, Jace, he yells to his friend. He can hardly see his friend's face through all the water. Jason is only a couple of feet away, but he's in such precarious position and in such a tight space, Andrew can't easily pull him out. Keep on coming, dude, toward me. Head up. Jason is flailing. Place your feet against me. Lift your butt up and float. Come on, Jays. Jason's gloved hand emerged from the water, then his wet face. He is gulping air as if he have the hiccups. My leg's caught. Jason doesn't recognize his own voice because it come out so slurred and slow, as if he suffered a stroke. He tries to dislodge his boot. It won't budge. It's okay, dude, Andrew says, reaching out to the rushing water and fishing around for the stuck boot. He grasps something solid. Is this it? Yeah? Well, we got ourselves in a jam, okay? We'll do this together. 20 minutes after getting stuck, Jace emerges from Bastard's Crawl like a baby being birthed, wet through, eyes shut tight, and gasping. Andrew settles him into a narrow ledge, inches above the water. Jason, his eyes now wide open and looking bewildered, know he has a close escape. "You're okay," Andrew says, grasping his shoulders. "Zach, stay with Jason while I get the supply bags up ahead." Takes him about 15 minutes. On his return, Andrew tells Zach the water is still rising, so he should join Matt and Arthur just beyond Bastard's Crawl. "I have to get Jason warmed up before we try to get out," he says. "If we don't catch up to you in 30 minutes, notify search and rescue." Unspoken is Andrew's fear that Jason is turning hypothermic, so cold that he has stopped shivering. He wraps his friend in the Mylar blanket and fixes up the jet boil. He warms Jason by pouring hot water down his clothes. As he does so, Jason's color starts to returning to normal. "Welcome back, buddy. You really ready to get out of here?" With an hour hike to the entrance, they start to climb. Inundated by water, they're fighting it, or it's fighting them, crushing them, pushing them back. When they find it near the top of the crawl, there are barely 4 inches of air left between the water and the ceiling, not enough for them to keep their heads up to breathe. "It's too high," Andrew calls. "Turn back." Jason spots a ledge. Although the wall is at an awkward angle at 45 degrees, there is enough room for the two of them. Andrew perches in front of Jason to take the brunt of the spray from the water, his legs uncomfortably braced against a ledge on the other side of the waterfall. The water keeps rising, almost to the ledge, and its sheer force and fury cause a wind to come up. Both men know that caves have their own microclimates. With nowhere to go, the wind whistles and keens. It is 6 p.m. They are about 200 feet underground at this point. Zach left them 3 hours ago. They huddle together under a blanket. The jet boil is out of fuel. "If we don't get out of here, our wives will kill us," Jason says dryly. And there's a picture of Andrew and Jason. They continued caving. Conserving the batteries in their headlamps, they sit mostly in the dark, which makes them forget what a tight space they are in. Jason draws on his theatrical training, forcing his breathing to slow down and move through his diaphragm, up to the tip of his skull. Trying to warm his face, he pulls his sweatshirt up over his nose. He thinks about his family and wonders how much life insurance coverage he has. Andrew silently recites a mantra based on a passage from the science fiction novel Dune. "Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little black death that brings total oblivion. I will let the fear pass through me, and when the fear is gone, only I will remain." There's no sign of rescuers. Did the other three even make it out? Maybe they're lying on the other side of Bastard's Crawl, blocked by water and injured or dead. What the two men don't know is that their friends did make it out. They called for help, and around 9 p.m., members of the ground and cave search and rescue squads arrived on the scene and entered the cave. But the water level, as well as its ferocity, forced them to retreat. They would have to try again later. The hours pass. Jason and Andrew don't dare move for fear of slipping. They doze off, then jerk themselves awake, and they check in with each other every 20 minutes or so. "You still with me?" Andrew asks. "Yep." "You still good?" "Yep." Every once in a while, one of them turns on his headlamp to scan the water level. Around 5 a.m., it seems to be receding. "Let's wait for a bit and see," Andrew says. An hour later, the water level has gone down enough that they can keep their heads above water and try and escape. Stiff from sitting in one position for 12 hours, they slowly unfold their bodies. Jason screams in pain. A muscle in his groin is strained, but he is determined not to let it stop him. Getting all fours and through Bastard's Crawl, nothing else matters but that. Still, each time Jason moves a leg, he cries out, "You can do this," Andrew exhorts. Then they are through. Over the next 90 minutes, they make their way toward the entrance, at times in chest-high water. Now in a passage that's high enough for them to walk upright, Jason sees something flicker in the distance. "Lights! I see lights!" Jason plows ahead. Soon they hear voices. "Hey," they call out, "we're here." "Andrew? Jason?" It's one of the rescuers. For the first time since entering the cave over 20 hours earlier, Jason's emotions get to him, and tears trickle down his cheek. "We made it." Why nomenclature isn't the study of gnomes? Mineralogy, the study of minerals. Oceanology, the study of oceans. Meteorology, not about meteors. And with last, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. My smartphone battery dies quickly. What can I do to make it last longer? There are a few strategies you can use to conserve a phone's battery power, says Rich Frisco, CR's head of smartphone testing. To start, go to your phone setting, battery menu, to see whether you have a low power mode or a battery saver that can be activated. What these do, and you can do it a la carte if your phone doesn't have the catch call setting, is lower the screen's brightness, also disable non-notifications from apps such as Facebook and Spotify, and if you use an animated wallpaper on your home screen, switch to a static one, such as a photo. For Android phone owners, Frisco also recommends checking your widgets, which are Android phone features that give you real-time looks at what your various apps are doing. If they're live and constantly updating, he says, disable or delete them. If none of this helps appreciably, check your battery's capacity. Recent updates to iOS let you monitor your iPhone's battery health in settings. You can do the same thing with Android phones by downloading an app. Frisco uses one called AccuBattery that shows what percentage of the original capacity your battery is currently operating at. If it's less than 80%, you may want to replace the battery. Keep in mind that Apple is offering $29 battery replacements through the end of 2018 for models dating back to the iPhone 6. If you own a 6S, you may be eligible for a free replacement stemming from problems with some models manufactured in 2015. In the know, is green juice healthy? Sold everywhere from Whole Foods to Starbucks, green juices offer a way to get nutrients and veggies you might not be getting enough of, says Amy Keating, a registered dietitian at Consumer Reports. But they aren't a substitute for whole vegetables. Below, you'll find a few worthwhile options, but heed this advice. Scan for sugar. Some drinks tout no sugar added, but have a lot of natural sugars from fruit juice. Naked Jute Boosted Smoothie Green Machine has 53 grams of natural sugars in 15 ounces, more than the added sugars in the same amount of Coca-Cola. Check the sodium. Many green drinks don't add salt, but some vegetables such as beets and celery have a surprising amount of natural sodium. Evolution's Fresh Organic Green Devotion includes celery juice as the first ingredient. It has 300 milligrams of sodium per serving, higher than many of its counterparts. Don't believe the miracle claims. Be wary of claims with specific benefits, including better sleep and glowing skin, a more balanced body, and cleansed blood. Don't take these claims at face value, Keating says, and check whether or not the companies have the research to back it up. And spot tricky serving sizes. Some Bold House Farms and Suja drinks, for example, list a serving size as only half a bottle. A distracted glance may have you lull you into thinking you're consuming half the sodium, sugar, and calories that are in the whole bottles. And here's a listing of it. Evolution Fresh Organic Emerald Green, 11 ounces for $5, 14 grams of sugar and 90 grams of sodium. Sold at Starbucks, this juice is low in sodium, but also contains apple juice, which increases its sugar count. Daily Greens Purity, 9 grams of sugar and 180 grams of sodium. It's claimed to pack in 4.5 pounds of produce. This is a 12-ounce container, by the way, including broccoli, kale, and celery, with low sugars. It is also USDA organic. Suja 12 Essentials, 16 ounces for $8, 8 grams of sugar, 230 milligrams of sodium. Almost all herbs and veggies, this bottle steers clear of fruit except for a bit of lemon juice, which keeps its sugars low, but the sodium's pretty high. Blueprint Organic Motion Potion, 12 ounces for $8, 10 grams of sugar, 38 milligrams of sodium. With four leafy greens and more than this bottle and more, this bottle contains a good dose of vitamins A and C, fiber, and potassium. Food Sleuth, how full is your fridge? Your new fridge may have a lot less storage space, some models as much as 32% less than the claimed capacity on its sticker. The industry capacity calculators don't deduct space taken up by shelves, containers, ice makers, and light housing, according to Joe Pacella, who leads CR's testing. Picture the refrigerator stripped bare to the walls. But CR's test engineers calculated each model's usable storage capacity by measuring each shelf, door, bin, and drawer, and subtracting the volume taken up by the ice makers, water filters, lights, and vents. This leaves behind only the space that foods can occupy, called total usable capacity, which we note in our ratings. If you have a French door thing, it's claiming 25 cubic feet, it might actually only have 17%. For side-by-side, it might only have almost 29% less space than claimed. Bottom freezer, 26% less, and top freezer, 17% less. How heat retention in mattresses? Many of the tests we perform on mattresses at CR use human subjects to help us evaluate, say, how supportive a specific mattress is. But when it comes to testing whether a mattress traps body heat, we rely solely on technology. Testers move the mattresses into a temperature-controlled room and place a roughly 12 by 16 inch copper plate encased in the insulated metal box, the picture of which there is, except for where the plate meets the mattress on the corners in the center of the bed. Then we run an electrical current through the plate, which warms it to 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, stimulating a sleepy average body temperature. Over the course of 10 hours, testers note how much energy the copper plate uses to maintain its 98.6 degree Fahrenheit. If a mattress dissipates heat well, more energy is needed to maintain the set temperature of the copper plate. But if the mattress retains heat, less energy is needed. Cool product features of the month. Chill out on these mattresses. The bedroom can be a hotbed of arguments, of one of which is who hot and who is too cold. But picking the right mattress can be part of the solution. Mattresses are built in layers that may include fabric, foam, batting coils, and gel in different colors and orders and thicknesses, and some materials may trap more heat than others. You're likely to sleep warm on a foam mattress compared to a hybrid innerspring, which we define as several inches of foam layers over metal springs, says Chris Reagan. Despite having a layer of cooling gel foam, a larger percentage of foam models still retain warmth. For example, Sleep on a Latex's Pure Green foam model has two latex foam layers and retains a fair amount of heat. To keep you snoozing comfortably, here are the models tested that trap the little body heat in our test and four that sleep warmer. The coolest, Sleep Number C2 Adjustable Air Mattress at $900. Purple the Purple foam mattress, $1,000. Duxiana Duck's 1001 Inner Spring Mattress at $49.50. Woo! $4,950, almost $5,000 for a mattress. And My Green Mattress Natural Escape at $1,200. The warmest was the Sleep Number 360 i8 Smart Bed Adjustable Air Mattress at $3,200. And Sleep on Latex Pure Green Firm Foam Mattress at $1,200. Sleep Innovations Marley Foam Mattress at $430. And Charles P. Rogers St. Regis Pillow Top Innerspring Mattresses at $1,100. And then we have a thing about, which is kind of interesting, about the time travel for laundry. 1937, after our first test of washing machines, we warned that the ones with wringers may expel water are very dangerous after catching users' hands, sleeves, or hair in them. Didn't even think about that. In 1943, the state of wartime laundry is little short of tragic. Many plants have closed down, we report. Laundering at home, we say, saves cash and helps the war effort. In 1950, we test new so-called hands-free models with some automatic features, but many, like this easy model above, and it shows a woman over a sink-like thing, still have a separate tub for rinsing and spin-drying clothes, requiring manual operation. In 1960, in our appliance lab, we measure an automatic washing machine's hot and cold water consumption at controlled water pressure using the gauges shown in the photo above. There's a whole bunch of gauges here. In 1966, our dryer tests, we focus on metal with promising new technology, automatic dryer control and moisture sensors. Report that models full with doors and large openings like this, like the ones above, are cool. 1970, we report that the phosphorus contents of many laundry detergents help turn the nation's lakes and streams into reservoirs of striking slime. And we call on the government to support research for effective lower phosphorus detergents. In 1979, as we test new dryers, we factor in laundry basket placement. The filtered air, which we show above, leaves room for one, but the GE on left does not. 1991, Whirlpool makes about half the washers in the country, and several sit at the top of our ratings. Also, a Whirlpool's agitator is best at circulating laundry in our tests. And in 2018, of the front-loaded washers we've tested, LG, Maytag, and Samsung brands get top marks. And the LG set, which is pictured below, is the quietest front-loader in our ratings, and it goes for about $1,800. Smartwatch Showdown. Fitbit's new Versa smartwatch looks sharp and has many of the same functions that Apple Watch users love. It will count your steps, track your heart rate, and relay call or text alerts from your phone. Though rigorous testing, we compared the Versa with the Apple Watch Series 3, and the results were surprisingly similar. The Apple Watch had a very slight edge in terms of being a bit easier to use and having a more accurate heart rate monitor, but the Versa was able to keep pace with the Apple Watch in almost every other way, is comparable with more devices, and has a much longer claimed battery life, making a good choice, we think, for more than $100 less. The Versa Fitbit at $200 got an overall score of 90. The Apple Watch Series 3 at $330 got a 91. Okay, what's the average claimed battery life? For the Versa, it's 4 days. For the Apple, it's 18 hours. Heart rate monitor accuracy? The Apple got a higher rating. Step count accuracy? About the same. Scratch test? Neither of them did very well on that. Ease of use? Both of them got good ratings. Ease of pairing? Both got good ratings. Reliability in bright and low light? Both got high ratings. And phone capability? And if the Versa has iOS, Android, and Windows, and, of course, the Apple only has Apple. And then we have the thing that has the 100-calorie salad fixings, what that looks like. Start with a nutritious base of dark leafy greens, then load up on colorful veggies. Just be mindful of portrait size when it comes to dressing or treats like bacon bits. 2 ounces of California avocado is 100 calories. 3 tablespoons of bacon bits is 100 calories. One half cup of Indomame is 100 calories. 1 1/4 large hard-boiled egg is 100 calories. 3 tablespoons of Italian dressing. And 1/4 cup of tuna fish. And August is the best time to buy air purifiers. As summer allergy season fades, keep an eye out for good prices on air purifiers. Laptops. Check back-to-school sales for great deals on a new laptop computer. Headphones. You may see prices drop this month with the deepest discounts on wired models. Then we have the recalls, which are kind of important, so I'll run through these. Takata airbags and Ford and Mazda pickups. In an ongoing recall that started more than 2 years ago, 46 million Takata airbag inflators and 34 million vehicles have been recalled. But the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration issued a fresh warning for some 2006 Ford Ranger and Mazda B-Series vehicles, which contain dangerously defective Takata airbag inflators that show a far higher risk of ruptures during airbag deployment than for other recalled Takata airbags. I cannot stress strongly enough the urgency of this recall, says Heidi King of the National Traffic Safety Association. What to do? Owners should stop driving immediately until their defective Takata airbags, which have caused injuries and death, are replaced. Go to nhtsa.gov/recalls. If your vehicle is listed, contact a dealer immediately to arrange a free repair. Fiat Chrysler vehicles. Fiat Chrysler Automobiles is recalling an estimated 4.8 million Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles because the driver might be unable to cancel cruise control. However, cruise control acceleration can be overpowered by applying the brakes. The model included the Chrysler 2015 to 2017 200 sedan, 2014-2018 300 sedan, and 2017 and 2018 Pacifica minivan, Dodge 2015-2018 Challenger Coupe, and 2014-2018 Charger Sedan, the Journey CUV, Durango SUV, the Jeep 2014-2018 Cherokee, and Grand Cherokee SUVs and 2018 Wranglers and Rams, and the 2014-2018 2500 and 3500 pickups and 3500-4500/5500 cab chassis. What to do? FCA advises drivers to avoid using cruise control until your vehicle is equipped with free upgraded software. Call 866-200-6747 for details. Jeep Cherokee SUVs. Fiat Chrysler Automobiles is recalling 49,000 2018 Jeep Cherokee SUVs with a 2.4-liter inline 4 engines because a damaged fuel tube in the engine bay could leak and cause a fire. What to do? Contact your Jeep dealership for a free replacement of the potential leaky fuel tube. Electric chainsaws. Harbor Freight Tools is recalling about 1 million Portland Oregon Stop Gardens and Chicago Electric chainsaws because the power switch can malfunction and the chainsaw continue operating after you move the switch to the off position. Poses a serious injury hazard. Chainsaws were sold at Harbor Freight Tool Stores and website through May 2019 through February 2018 for about $50. What to do? Stop using it and call Harbor Freight Tools at 1-800-444-3353 or go to harborfreight.com for details on how to get a free replacement. Children's sweaters. Carter's is recalling about 100,000 three-piece penguin cardigan sets because the toggle can detach and pose a choking hazard. The sets were sold at stores and online from July 2017 through March 2018 for about $40. What to do? Take the sets away from children, return them to any Carter store for a refund gift card, or call Carter's at 1-800-692-4674 to get a free shipping label and envelope to return the set by mail in exchange for an e-gift card. Bath toys. Munchkin is recalling about 72,000 water-peed bath toys because the toys can break into pieces and expose small parts, posing a choking hazard for young children. The toys were sold at stores nationwide and online at munchkin.com from September 2015 through January 2018 for $5 to $7. What to do? Take the toy away from young children and call Munchkin at 877-242-3134 or go to munchkin.com to get a free replacement toy. Coffee cans. Lily is recalling about 65,000 8.8 whole bean coffee cans because the lid can detach suddenly and with force when you open it due to a missing air valve on the bottom, posing a risk of injury. The cans were sold at stores and online from November 2017 through May 2018 for about $15. What to do? Don't open the can. Call Lily at 855-282-4682 or go to lily.com can info for free replacement. Mini deep fryers. Aldi is recalling about 35,000 Ambiano mini deep fryers because the heating element could overheat, posing a fire and burn hazard. The fryers were sold at Aldi stores nationwide from February of this year, 2018, through March, for about $15. What to do? Stop using the fryer and return it to any Aldi store for a refund. Call Aldi at 1-800-366-9967 or go to Aldi US for details. Strollers. Janae is recalling about 800 mum strollers because they violate the federal stroller and carriage standard. An unrestrained infant can slide through the opening between the stroller armrest and the seat bottom and entrap his head and neck, posing a strangulation hazard. The strollers were sold at stores and online from July 2016 through August 2017 for $300 to $450. What to do? Stop using the stroller. Call 844-200-7971 or go to jane/usa.com to get a free replacement armrest. In the meantime, you can use a stroller if you remove the armrest and harness the child properly. Hard hats. This is a little unusual. Honeywell's recalling about 82,000 fiber metal E2 and North Peak A79 hard hats because they can fail to protect you from impact, posing a risk of head injury. The hats were sold by industrial protective equipment distributor stores at online from April 2016 through January 2018 for $7 to $21. What to do? Stop using it and call Honeywell at 888-212-6903 or go to honeywellsafety.com to get a product credit or voucher equal to the purchase price of your hard hat. The mosquito meets its match. Insect repellents can ward off mosquitoes and ticks and prevent diseases they carry. Our testing revealed which products will help protect you and your family. 44% of consumers think that natural pest control products work as well as conventional ones, but most natural repellents we test perform in the poor range, says Joan Muratore, CR's insect repellent test leader. One of our recommended products is an exception. It contains oil of lemon eucalyptus. Most with excellent ratings use DEET. Readers with a digital or all-access membership can find us through cr.org/repellents0818. More than just warm weather nuisance, mosquitoes and ticks spread illnesses including West Nile and Zika viruses and Lyme disease. Insect repellents can protect against these pests, but our testing shows that not all of them are equal. We find great variation among products and how well they protect, says Joan Muratore. Only our recommended products are shown below. All of them contain one of the following active ingredients, DEET. Most of our recommended repellents contain 15 to 30% DEET. Research has shown that DEET is safe at those levels when used as directed, even for pregnant women and kids, Don't use it on infants younger than 2 months. Picardner Oil of Lemon Eucalyptus, OLE. Two products containing Picardner OLE also did well in our test. Research suggests both are safe, although OLE should not be used on children younger than 3 years old. Our testers found that repellents, sprays, lotions, and wipes could all be effective, but proper application is key. Follow the directions on the label and these 5 tips for best results. 1. Apply a thin coat to all exposed skin, but avoid the eyes and mouth and use sparingly around your ears. Do not apply under clothing. Adults should spray repellent on their hands to apply to children. Don't spray on kids or apply their hands to avoid getting in their eyes or mouth. Frequent application isn't necessary. Wash hands after applying and wash off the repellent at the end of the day. Never spray directly into the face. Spray on palms, then apply to the face. And when using towelettes, be sure to use enough of them to cover all exposed skin with the repellent. And here's a listing of the different brands. Total Home, CVS Woodland Scent Insect Repellent, was apparently the most economical. It ranked number 1 at $6. Off, Deep Woods Insect Repellent was number 2 at $6 as well. Repel, plant-based lemon eucalyptus insect repellent, was number 3 at $5. Ben's 30% DEET Tick and Insect Repellent at $8 was number 4. Number 5 was Coleman Insect Repellent at $7. Number 6 was Sawyer Premium Insect Repellent, 20% Picardin, $8. Number 7 was Repel Insect Repellent, Scented Family, 15% DEET, at $4. Repel Insect Repellent Sportsman Formula Dry, 25% DEET, at $5. Off Deep Woods Sportsman Insect Repellent 2, at $6. Number 10 was Cutter Backwoods Dry Insect Repellent at $6. And number 11 was Natural Tick and Insect Repellent at $9. For a lotion, Sawyer Insect Repellent number 30 was $10. And towelettes are Repel Insect Repellent Mosquito Wipes 30% deep at $5. And off Deep Woods Insect Repellent towelettes at $6.50. Now for a road report. Tips from the test track. How to ace the test drive for your new car. Plan your own route. Skip the dealer's recommended route. Pick your own path and make sure it includes rough pavement, a twisty switch, and highway driving. Allow at least a half hour for each test drive. That's about twice than what they usually want you to do. Number 2, do back-to-back drives. Drive all of your candidate cars on the same day so you have a level playing field of impressions. After each test drive, take notes so that you can remember all of the important details about every car later. And number 3, listen up. Spend part of your drive time with the music off and no chatter so that you can listen for road or wind noise in the cabin, as well as how the engine responds when you accelerate. The vital statistic, 20% of Americans who say they're likely to buy an electric car, up from 15% in 2017. And should I get UHP tires? All-season and summer ultra-high-performance UHP tires are built for grip and responsive steering, but they tend to wear faster than regular tires and can make up a stiffer ride, says Gene Friederson, CR's tire expert. Our testing of all-season UHP tires shows that some have a tread life as low as 30,000 miles. We recommend the all-season UHP BH Goodrich G-Force Comp 2AS for a relatively low price and tread life of 60,000 miles. Digital or all-access members can go to CR.org tires for full tire ratings. And it shows $116 for that particular tire. And just for fun, let's finish up with a road report, a road test, on the BMW X2, more sport than utility. Road test score was 77. Handling, responsive engine and transmission, fit and finish for front seat comfort. That's the highs. The lows was visibility, ride, road noise, blind spot warning not available. Powertrain, 228 horsepower, 2.0-liter four-cylinder turbo engine, 8-speed automatic and all-wheel drive. Fuel is 25 miles per gallon on premium fuel. Price attested was $46,000. The X2 drives like a sports car when navigating curvy roads, but that feeling of exhilaration is quickly tempered by the firm, choppy ride. The X2 is more performance-oriented than the X1 SUV that it's based on. His turbo engine provides snappy acceleration along with a satisfying growl, and the transmission shifts promptly and smoothly. It's not hard to imagine some buyers wishing for a little more calm and quieter cabin from this entry-level luxury SUV. Drivers will also hear elevated levels of tire noise when rolling over rough surfaces. As with other BMWs, the X2 exterior has a high-quality vibe. The controls are easy to use, and drivers don't have to wade through too many menus on the infotainment system. Even interacting with the display screen is logical. The faux leather front seats are comfortable and supportive. Because it's this low to the ground, drivers might feel like they're sitting in a car rather than an SUV. In the rear, the seats are snug, and the cargo volume is several cubic feet smaller than the space in the more upright X1. The rear view is minimized by the X2 sloping roofline, chunky back pillars, and slit-like rear window. And the blind spot and rear cross-traffic warning systems aren't available to help drivers feel more secure. Forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking are optional. Consumer Reports believe that manufacturers should offer these two important safety features on all cars, regardless of the trim level. They also do a review on the Jaguar E-Pace, which is the Jaguar's brand new SUV, but it only got a 48 overall score. The highs, handling and braking, standard advanced safety equipment. The lows, uneven power, delivery, ride, visibility, and controls. The powertrain is a 246-horsepower, 2.0-liter four-cylinder turbo engine, 9-speed automatic and all-wheel drive. The fuel is 21 miles per gallon on premium fuel, and the price is at $48,000. The Frisky Pace E-Pace small luxury SUV has curvaceous styling, a perky engine, and sharp handling, but we don't think it's luxurious or refined enough for the price. The E-Pace has responsive steering and doesn't lean much when taking corners, making an entertaining drive. Cruising around town, however, exposes the E-Pace's jerky drivetrain and bumpy ride. There's a notable delay when starting from a standstill. After the slow start, the engine then delivers an excessive burst of power. The uneven acceleration is made worse by the automatic transmission, which is neither smooth nor responsive. The cabin ambience is dreary with lots of hard, smooth plastic and dark colors, although some surfaces are padded and have attractive stitching. And with that, we've about run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at the website triangleReadingService.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.